Rachel Larvey, reel 7.
I can't remember how far I got to about the reel 7.
You were saying about the two ladies, why one was holding the other.
That's right. It was a Bosnian a Serb lady holding a Muslim lady, even older than she, as a detainee in her own home, in retaliation for this woman, captor's daughter, being held in the jail by the other side. Most extraordinary, and a situation that was known to the local authorities, who had happily handed this woman over to this other woman's care, detention, as a sort of thing that is acceptable and happens in a war. And so here we had this very old woman. At first she was just kept in a basement of this other woman's house and not allowed out, not allowed upstairs. Just a prisoner in a home. And it was actually brought to our attention by a local Red Cross authority, because it was common knowledge in the local community, and people didn't do anything about it, either because they didn't seem to think it mattered, or they didn't care, or they were too afraid to say anything. But the local Red Cross did, and so as the ICRC we got involved and went to visit. And this woman had in fact been beaten by the other woman with a wooden spoon, and it all sounds terribly sort of strange and domestic, but it had a really bitter and nasty twist to it, because it was just a reflection of the whole war. I left before that situation was fully resolved, so I don't know what happened. But it was good that we knew about it, because we were then able to make regular visits to see these two women. I mean, to all intents and purposes, they could have just been two old women, but when you knew the whole story behind it, that one of them was completely at the mercy of the other, it was extraordinary. That story didn't end, you know, that wasn't too unpleasant a one, really. I mean, it was just sort of a domestic, well, slightly violent, but not as horrific as some of the beatings that we saw in the jails. Prisoners who would be subjected to kicking and beating by the guards, so much so that they were peeing blood and terribly swollen and bruised and couldn't stand or walk in some places. And a lot of them would not want me to know, or if they did reluctantly agree to be seen by me, to not to have it brought to the attention of the authorities. So I would just make detailed reports, which would then be filed, but it was totally confidential. And that's one thing you have to respect, the confidentiality of the witness. And this is another thing that the ICRC is terribly hot on, obviously. Will not be able to say anything in war trials, because we have to maintain confidentiality about things that we have seen and known. Difficult.
So you couldn't be called as a witness, for instance?
No.
How do you feel about that?
Again, there were times when I would like to have shouted to the world about what I had seen, the goings-on I had seen. But I think that the greater good will ultimately be done by continually being able to carry on doing this work, and it would jeopardise that if I said anything. And you have to think of it like that long term, that the greater good has to be kept by keeping your mouth shut at certain times. There may be times when it's all public and it's okay to talk, but there are times when you can't identify people and jeopardise the work of the ICRC that is still ongoing somewhere. That's what I mean. There is a guy who was the prison officer of one jail in a Serb jail that's holding Bosnian Muslims. I don't know if I can say his name, it's only his nickname. And every time I looked at him, I'd think, war criminal. He was a huge, hulking guy. And he terrorized me. I was terrified of him. He had a really nasty sort of sardonic smile and huge hands and a massive great big neck, and he would just grip your hand and sort of crunch it to a pulp almost, and denied anything untoward that was ever going on in his jail, and was just so creepy that he put the fear of God into me, really. And I remember he would say things like, "I can make your work so difficult that you'll never leave here," or, "I can arrest you on sight if I wish." And he was just really horrible and unpleasant to work with. And I'm sure he's committed some pretty awful things with those hands of his, which I would look at. But I don't know anyway, do I, for sure? I haven't seen anything. I've just heard what prisoners have told me. It's their word for it against his, isn't it?
When one sees those very sort of emaciated concentration World War II camp pictures, did you see people, you know the ones I'm meaning about, I think.
Yeah.
Did you see people looking like that in, you know, camps of whatever description?
I never saw people as bad as that. I know they existed because I saw them on the screen as well, and I know that the Red Cross were amongst the first to go in when these people, some of these camps were opened and they were released. And I'm sure there must still be more that we don't know about. But of the jails that I visited, as I say, when we had access to them and we knew what was going on and how little food people were getting, we took that decision to supply them with food before they got to the point of being skeletal like that. And that was the right decision. I mean, you cannot morally sit back and look at people being starved to death. So it's only in those places that nobody had access to that the detainees were able to get into such a position, I think. But I do wonder if there are more that we didn't know about. I mean, it's still ongoing, really, although things are changing all the time in Bosnia. But I think we'll still discover more atrocities.
What were the relationships like? I mean, it's a theme that's gone right the way through, between the UN and the Red Cross and other agencies working there. Were there any sort of problems in Sarajevo?
Here, I think, is where I saw it not work as well as it has done in other instances. Loads of agencies wanted to come in and work in Sarajevo. I think it's where, you know, the big spotlight was, really. People wanted to get in. And apart from the Red Cross, other agencies, other smaller NGOs, have to work under the UNHCR umbrellaship. And it wasn't well coordinated. There were a lot of people coming in and doing things that were already being done, and people overlapping, and people doing all sorts of things which didn't really need to be done. I think just sometimes to get notoriety, really, to get press coverage, to get... Probably it was easy to get funding, too, for Bosnia. So it was a bit disappointing and disheartening sometimes to see the forms of aid that was coming in and the duplicated aid that was being given. The Red Cross's work is so totally separate and distinct, and we made more sure of it than ever there, as I say, because of our vehicles needing to be seen to be different from other vehicles. Our plane, for example, we didn't want to be shot at. We didn't want any risks of anything to jeopardise us getting across to the other side to visit detainees and things. And doing all the negotiations with the release of prisoners, it would have been very detrimental if we had been seen to be at one with UNHCR. So much so that we were not really even allowed to travel in UN vehicles. Always take a Red Cross vehicle. And I mean, in a place where fuel is really short, it seemed crazy sometimes to be going to the same meeting with people from other agencies, but have to go in your own car. And similarly, we weren't really meant to take them in our cars. And obviously that did happen, and it certainly happened off-duty hours, as it were. But for any major meeting, we were always seen to be going and coming back totally separately and independently. We did try to cooperate with UNHCR. We're not working in opposition to them. But there are times when I felt, and this is a personal feeling, that UNHCR... did not really stick to a strong moral code as to how to work, whereas ICRC, I felt, always stuck to its principles. Now, one occasion I can cite is when the airport was closed. No, the airport was open, but the checkpoint, sorry, between the airport and the city, the Serbs were being particularly belligerent and were not letting anybody through this checkpoint with any goods into the city, because they were feeling that the Serb side was not getting as much as the Muslim side, and therefore they won't allow anything in. Now, UNHCR seemed to think it was okay to try and sneak things round the back way, hidden in APCs, which is armoured personnel carriers, and come round the back route. And this was a route that was not officially recognised, and you could be shot at using it. ICRC didn't feel we could do that. We felt that we should always do things openly and up front. And as I say, I think we were privileged as ICRC that we were usually respected for that and allowed to do it, because we were seen to be working equally on both sides. They would make an exception and allow us through. And that happened on numerous occasions. And I don't know whether UNHCR were right to bring things in sneakily like that. I don't know. War's a dirty game, and you've got to decide where you draw the line and what morality you're going to stick to, what moral code you're going to abide by. But I wasn't always impressed by UNHCR.
Were you there during the airstrikes?
Yeah, I was. Yes. Difficult there with your neutrality, I can tell you, because you're living in Sarajevo with Sarajevan citizens and friends, and you know, when the Serbs are shelling the city and sniping at you, you obviously don't want them to do it, and you want it to be stopped. And so there's a certain amount of community spirit when the airstrikes are happening against Serb military bases and artillery bases and ammunition bases, that you're cheering them on, and the planes are British planes, some of them as well, and you kind of feel this relief and cheer in your heart when you hear that there have been airstrikes. So that's where you battle with your neutrality. But I was under siege as well. I was a citizen of Sarajevo for that time. It wasn't scary. It was good, because you felt it was going to bring an end to what was going on.
And do you think it has? No, helped. I mean, it's not at an end, we know, but things have altered, haven't they?
Mm.
Do you think it has?
It's a difficult one. I changed completely. I felt when I first went to Bosnia that we should keep out and leave the situation for the former Yugoslavian conflict to resolve itself. I felt that. When I got there and I realised that people were just pleading and imploring for the international community to take effect, I thought, we can't bury our heads in the ground and be that isolationist. We have to help, but we have to do it wholeheartedly. And I felt it was too little too late. We should have done it sooner, or we should have got properly involved sooner. And when we got properly involved, to stay committed to being involved instead of a couple of strikes here and then ignoring some great atrocity there. And then I just felt we were wishy-washy and that we needed to have a more firm approach right from the beginning and stick to it.
Of military intervention. So with the Americans coming in, you know, was that, how did you react to that when the Americans started taking a very sort of definite stance?
Slightly worried because of the Americans, who I think can be a bit brash and gung-ho when they come in, and that it could have been done in a more inflammatory way than was necessary. But I felt that they got to a point where they were talking so much, they had to do something. They couldn't just sit there and spout hot air when they had none of their own boys on the ground. It's always easy, isn't it, to look back and say how things would have been better managed. And I'm no politician or militarist, so I don't know. I don't know the real stories behind the whole politics and the interventions and whys and wherefores. I'm just an aid worker, but of course everyone has their own views. And it's not over yet. And I don't know if we've made it worse. But I know, what I do know is that we can't ignore it and that we have to do what we feel we can do. And for me, it's working there in an aid and relief capacity.
Would you like to go back?
Oh, yeah. Definitely. As I say, I extended my contract in Sarajevo, so I did 9 months, and then I would have happily extended again, but I couldn't. Because I'd been there 9 months continuous in Sarajevo and 6 months previously, that was 15 months in Bosnia, and the ICRC recognises that people shouldn't stay in one conflict situation for too long. It was quite stressful. I haven't really talked even about the general living under the threat of sniper fire and having to run between your car and your house. The general day-to-day life of living in a war zone is quite stressful. And you don't always recognise it in yourself, not until you're taken out of it, that you need a rest. The feeling often is, I've got to go on, I'm totally indispensable. And that's why it's so important that you do have time out, not just regularly during your mission assignment there, but when you come back, before you go somewhere else and maybe not stay in the same place for too long. I can see that now with hindsight. It doesn't stop me wanting to go back now. I'd love to. From Sarajevo, we were meant to have a long weekend out of the city every 3 weeks, which is quite frequent, but believe me, you need it. Now, it doesn't happen in practice because you can't get out. The airport is often closed. And so the longest I think I did was nine weeks in Sarajevo. By the end, I was nearly tearing my hair out. And I just thought, though, for the poor citizens of Sarajevo who don't get the opportunity to go out, I mean, I think 9 weeks is a long time, and some of them have been there for 3 years and have their families involved, and seeing their loved ones go off to the front line and come back or not come back, seeing friends and neighbours shot in the streets, and just witnessing every single day the appalling tragedies. And yet I know my family's safe and at home, and I can only cope with 3 weeks at a time. But the converse is that you don't have your friends and family, so you don't have your own support networks around you, and you are working extremely hard, whereas a lot of the people in Sarajevo are not working. I mean, they're just living, their life is surviving. We did work long and hard hours, and it was really tiring and exhausting. So at the end of 3 weeks, it was very welcome to get out. But there was also a feeling of, if I get out, will I get back in? And I had this overwhelming fear of being stuck outside Sarajevo if the airport closed in the interim meantime. I would far rather have stayed in and repeated another 9 weeks than be stuck outside on my long weekend off and not be able to get back in, and I knew there were needs there that I needed to be there for. But the joy of getting out was that you could go to places on the Croatian coast, and particularly in the summer. It's a beautiful part of the world. Lovely, idyllic islands. And of course, tourism has just collapsed around there. So there's lovely hotels with nobody in. Very cheap. And, you know, the beautiful sea and just totally wonderful, relaxing Mediterranean holiday. And then fly back into your war zone. And it made no end of difference. No end. Even if you felt you couldn't go, you didn't want to go, you'd be dragged kicking and screaming to get on that plane. You'd come back and think, yes, I did need to go. It was worth it and it was great. And not just for yourself, but for the people that you're working with. Because you become tired and irritable and uptight and stressed. And it's not fair on them if you don't go away and get a rest. And that's one good way of looking at it. And Boris, my right-hand man, I mean, he knew when I needed to go away as much as I did, and or probably better than I did, and he'd tell me. And I'd come back very much more refreshed and relaxed when I did get out. Yeah, the stresses build up continually because there are little things that happen every day in a war that if they happen here, they'd be a mega event in your week, in your life, in your... But it happens so all the time in the war. The continual shelling, I mean, it's always going on in the background around the city, even if it's not particularly close to where you are. You hear noises of explosions and the gunfire, and you just become very aware of it. And I know I'm very jumpy. If I hear a loud noise now, I'll still jump, because my nerves are such that they respond instantly, ready in case it's somewhere close and I need to run. I lived in a street where there was regular sniping. It was just across from the front line, and they would shoot down the street, snipers. And you had to run from the car to the front door. And things like that you get used to, because you live in that kind of a situation. But I do remember one particular incident which just brought home the whole Sarajevo story to me, really. It was near the end of my time, and I was sad to be leaving, very sad to be leaving, but it was right, and I wasn't to extend any more. And I was going to have a little party with all the friends that I'd made in the city. And I was trying to find some beer, and trying to find beer in Sarajevo is quite hard. You have to drive around lots and lots of places to get a few cans. And I was just driving down the main street, Sniper's Alley, in my armoured Land Rover, alone. But I had my medical box, my flak jacket, my helmet, as you always do. And thinking of where I was going to buy some beer. And suddenly, this guy who was walking, or rather running, because you usually run in Sarajevo, was shot by a sniper. And he fell to the ground. And he dropped his shopping bag and his potatoes rolled around. And I remember thinking, I've got to go to him. And I just jumped out. I put on my flak jacket and my helmet and took my medical bag. And I ran to him. And at the same time as I got to him, there were some French peacekeepers there who also got to him. And they radioed for an ambulance to come. But he was dead. He was actually shot in the head. So he must have died quite quickly. And we looked at each other, the French soldiers and I realised there was nothing I could do. And the French waited for the ambulance, who would then take him to the mortuary. And I went to get back in my Land Rover. And as I got back in, the press came running out of the Holiday Inn, where they all used to stay in the hotel, with the cameras, to get pictures. I get a story of another sniping incident in Sarajevo. And I wanted to get away before the press got there, because you build up a sort of unhealthy, well, a dislike really for the vulture-like press. And I drove off. But as I drove off, I just started immediately thinking again, where are they going to buy my beer? And I thought, you know, here am I criticising the press for coming to take pictures of this guy. But my life goes on too. And here am I again, immediately turning back to going to buy beer. And I suppose that's been really poignant, because it was almost my last day in Sarajevo. And it was just another incident in the day. And
were the press vulture-like?
I have to say, I then did develop a greater respect for the press as time wore on. I have the usual aid workers' distrust, dislike, particularly the ICRC's workers, mistrust of the press. Don't speak to them. But when we all lived together in the Holiday Inn, I actually came to respect many of them, really. The people like Martin Lewis, the BBC, the people that had been war correspondents for years, who had been to all the war zones, they cared, and they had given their lives over to doing what they were doing, because they believed as strongly in their work as I believed in my work, that what they were doing was important, and they were opening the eyes of the world to what was going on here. There are some who come in, you know, for the drama and the photos, and then fly out again. But they aren't the really committed ones. The really committed ones who live in pretty grim conditions and traipse around the world and give up their own personal private lives at home to be war correspondents, they I had tremendous respect for. And I lost more respect for the politicians and the people in the UN. So I made some good pals with the press, and I learned a lot from them. And it's a whole learning experience, all of this work, actually. And I think you need to go in very open-minded, and be prepared to shed all your preconceptions, because you will.
You were, of course, right in the midst of civil war, weren't you? In Yugoslavia.
Yes. Although some would say it's not a civil war, some would say it's an international war. It's a difficult thing to decide. But at the time, when you're caught up in it, it feels like you don't know anything else, really. And it's hard to remember life as it is back at home, and how normal life is. Sometimes we had CNN. When the electricity was on, rarely, we could get CNN television. And at that time, we saw the tragedy unfolding in Rwanda. I was in Sarajevo at the time of the Rwandan massacres. And I remember thinking that there had been more bloodshed and more people slaughtered in 2 weeks, I think, in Rwanda, than in 2 years in Bosnia. It was just a phenomenal statistic. The numbers of people slaughtered in Rwanda in such a short space of time.
So is it that overshadowed genocide, what was happening, do you think, compared with ex-Yugoslavia?
Hard to say what is genocide, and does genocide exist in ex-Yugoslavia? It was certainly genocide in Rwanda. I would agree with that. In ex-Yugoslavia, I think it's more complicated and more complex, and it's the Muslim and Serb and Croat labels that are placed on people is really an excuse, because it's a war, and the politicians that instigated that war and wanted that war to be a war, and they wanted to put a reason and to blame on that war. But it's been bubbling under the surface for so long, but it's complex and goes back a very long way into history, and it's more than I can understand, and it's more than most of the people of Bosnia can understand. But from my experience of the people that I met, and particularly in and around Sarajevo, where they are so ethnically mixed, was that they don't understand it themselves. They lived before, cheek by cheek, with Serbs, Croats, Muslims, all of the people together, and they were happy to live like that, and they would have happily gone on living like that. And this war has been brought upon them. And they didn't hate each other, not in the same way that the Tutsis and the Hutus. Genocide, I think we'll live to see more about that. I'm discovering more and more now from the television and from what is being found out as to what went on than when I was there. And we are now discovering mass graves, aren't we? And sites of mass burial and mass execution. And that was obviously very deliberate, rounding up of Muslims, separating off the women and children, and then just killing the men for being Muslims. That's what we've been finding recently, and I'm sure we'll go on to find more atrocities committed against the Serbs by the Muslims. We'll discover mass burial sites on all sides of the confrontation, and in the Croats as well. I had less to do with that, particularly in around central Bosnia, because the Croatian war was further away. But we know from evidences in history that these things have happened on all sides, between Serbs and Croats after the First World War, Second World War. So we'll carry on finding them, I'm sure. But then I did move into working in a place where there had been genocide, or amongst people who had been victims or perpetrators of genocide. And I went to Tanzania to work in a refugee camp with Rwandan refugees who'd fled their country following the massacres in 94. Now, the camps in Tanzania are predominantly Hutus in the camps, and the Tutsis are the people that are left in Rwanda now. So the slaughter had mainly been Hutus slaughtering Tutsis. This is simplifying it very much. The Tutsis then had an uprising and the Hutus fled. The guilty parties, as they're called, and fled out of Rwanda. Many of them fled north to Zaire, and many of them fled into Tanzania. I went to a place called Ngara, which is near the border of Tanzania and Rwanda, and that was the nearest small town. The refugees had settled about 30 miles from the town in set-up camps, which were set up of different numbers. About half a million refugees came into Tanzania, so roughly 500... Yeah, half a million refugees, and the camp that I worked in was called Lumasi Camp, which had 106,000 people. So quite an enormous number of people. And I was the coordinator of a curative health program in Lumasi Camp. And I worked here for Tear Fund, again, the people that I'd worked for in Kurdistan. We worked under UNHCR auspices, as did all the other NGOs, and here it was extremely well organised. UNHCR had a very, very good setup with excellent people at the top of each area head, so the medical setup and the community services setup and the